At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Chapter 25 and 26 of the Grand Babylon Hotel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Anna Simon. The Grand Babylon Hotel by Arnold Bennett. Chapter 25. The Steam Launch. Mr. Tom Jackson's notion of making good his escape from the hotel by means of a steam launch was an excellent one, so far as it went. But Theodore Wexell, for his part, did not consider that it went quite far enough. Theodore Wexell opined, with peculiar glee, that he now had a tangible and definite clue for the catching of the Grand Babylon's ex-waiter. He knew nothing of the port of London, but he happened to know a good deal of the far more complicated, though somewhat smaller, port of New York, and he felt sure there ought to be no extraordinary difficulty in getting hold of Jules' steam launch. To those who are not thoroughly familiar with it, the River Thames and its docks, from London Bridge to Gravesend, seems a vast and uncharted wilderness of craft, a wilderness in which it would be perfectly easy to hide even a three-master successfully. To such people, the idea of looking for a steam launch on the river would be about equivalent to the idea of looking for a needle in a bundle of hay. But the fact is, there are hundreds of men between St. Catherine's Wharf and Blackwall who literally know the Thames as a suburban householder knows his back garden, who can recognize thousands of ships and put a name to them at a distance of half a mile, who are informed as to every movement of vessels on the great stream, who know all the captains, all the engineers, all the lightermen, all the pilots, all the licensed watermen, and all the unlicensed scoundrels from the Tower to Gravesend, and a lot further. By these experts of the Thames, the slightest unusual event on the water is noticed and discussed. A wherry cannot change hands, but they will guess shrewdly upon the price paid and the intentions of the new owner with regard to it. They have a habit of watching the river for the mere interest of the sight, and they talk about everything, like housewives gathered of an evening round the cottage door. If the first mate of a castle liner gets the sack, they will be able to tell you what he said to the captain, what the old man said to him, and what both said to the board, and having finished off that affair, they will cheerfully turn to discussing whether Bill Stevens sank his barge outside the West Indian No. 2 by accident or on purpose. Theodore Wexell had no satisfactory means of identifying the steam launch which carried away Mr. Tom Jackson. The sky had clouded over soon after midnight, and there was also a slight mist, and he had only been able to make out that it was a low craft, about 60 feet long, probably painted black. He had personally kept a watch all through the night on vessels going upstream, and during the next morning he had a man to take his place who warned him whenever a steam launch went towards Westminster. At noon, after his conversation with Prince Aribert, he went down the river in a hired rowboat as far as the custom-house, and poked about everywhere in search of any vessel which could by any possibility be the one he was in search of. But he found nothing. He was, therefore, tolerably sure that the mysterious launch lay somewhere below the custom-house. At the custom-house stairs he landed, and asked for a very high official, an official inferior only to a commissioner, whom he had entertained once in New York, and who had met him in London on business at Lloyd's. In the large but dingy office of this great man a long conversation took place, a conversation in which Wexell had to exercise a certain amount of persuasive power, and which ultimately ended in the high official ringing his bell. "Desire Mr. Hazel, room number 332, to speak to me," said the official to the boy who answered the summons, and then, turning to Wexell, "I need hardly repeat, my dear Mr. Wexell, that this is strictly unofficial." "Agreed, of course," said Wexell. Mr. Hazel entered. He was a young man of about 30, dressed in blue serge, with a pale, keen face, a brown moustache, and a rather handsome brown beard. "Mr. Hazel," said the high official, "let me introduce you to Mr. Theodore Wexell. You will doubtless be familiar with his name. Mr. Hazel," he went on to Wexell, "is one of our outdoor staff, what we call an examining officer. Just now he's doing night duty. He has a boat on the river, and a couple of men, and the right to board and examine any craft whatever. What Mr. Hazel and his crew don't know about the Thames between here and Gravesend isn't knowledge." "Glad to meet you, sir," said Wexell simply, and they shook hands. Wraxall observed with satisfaction that Mr. Hazel was entirely at his ease. "Now, Hazel," the high official continued, "Mr. Wraxall wants you to help in a little private expedition on the river tonight. I will give you a night's leave. I sent for you partly because I thought you would enjoy the affair, and partly because I think I can rely on you to regard it as entirely unofficial, and not to talk about it. You understand? I dare say you will have no cause to regret having obliged Mr. Wraxall." "I think I grasp the situation," said Hazel, with a slight smile. "And, by the way," added the high official, "although the business is unofficial, it might be well if you wore your official overcoat. See?" "Decidedly," said Hazel. "I should have done so in any case." "And now, Mr. Hazel," said Wraxall, "will you do me the pleasure of lunching with me? If you agree, I should like to lunch at the place you usually frequent." So it came to pass that Theodore Wraxall and George Hazel, outdoor clerk in the customs, lunched together at Thomas's Chop House in the City of London upon mutton chops and coffee. The millionaire soon discovered that he had got hold of a keen-witted man and a person of much insight. "Tell me," said Hazel, when they had reached the cigarette stage, "are the magazine writers anything like correct?"
"What do you mean?" asked Wraxall, mystified.
"Well, you're a millionaire, one of the best, I believe. One often sees articles on and interviews with millionaires, which describe their private railroad cars, their steam yachts on the Hudson, their marble stables, and so on, and so on. Do you happen to have those things?" "I have a private car on the New York Central, and I have a 2,000-ton schooner yacht, though it isn't on the Hudson. It happens just now to be on East River. And I'm bound to admit that the stables of my uptown place are fitted with marble." "Ah," said Hazel, "now I can believe that I'm lunching with a millionaire. It is strange how facts like those, unimportant in themselves, appeal to the imagination. You seem to me a real millionaire now. You've given me some personal information. I'll give you some in return. I earn 300 a year, and perhaps £60 a year extra for overtime. I live by myself, in two rooms in Musquey Court. I've as much money as I need, and I always do exactly what I like outside office. As regards the office, I do as little work as I can, on principle. It's a fight between us and the commissioners who shall get the best. They try to do us down, and we try to do them down. It's pretty even on the whole. All's fair in war, you know, and there ain't no 10 commandments in a government office." Wraxall laughed. "Can you get off this afternoon?" he asked. "Certainly," said Hazel. "I'll get one of my pals to sign on for me, and then I shall be free."
"Well," said Wraxall, "I should like you to come down with me to the Grand Babylon. Then we can talk over my little affair at length. And may we go on your boat? I want to meet your crew."
"That will be all right," Hazel remarked. "My two men are the idlest, most soulless chaps you ever saw. They eat too much, and they have an enormous appetite for beer. But they know the river, and they know their business. And they will do anything within the fair game if they're paid for it, and aren't asked to hurry." That night, just after dark, Theodore Wraxall embarked with his new friend George Hazel in one of the black-painted customs wherries, manned by a crew of two men, both the latter freemen of the river, a distinction which carries with it certain privileges unfamiliar to the mere landsman. It was a cloudy and oppressive evening, not a star showing to illumine the slow tide, now just past its flood. The vast forms of steamers at anchor, chiefly those of the General Steam Navigation and the Aberdeen Line, heaved themselves high out of the water, straining sluggishly at their mooring buoys. On either side, the naked walls of warehouses rose like grey precipices from the stream, holding forth quaint arms of steam cranes. To the west, the Tower Bridge spanned the river with its formidable arch, and above that its suspended footpath, 150 feet from earth. Down towards the east and the Pool of London, a forest of funnels and masts was dimly outlined against the sinister sky. Huge barges, each steered by a single man at the end of a pair of giant oars, lumbered and swirled downstream at all angles. Occasionally a tug snorted busily past, flashing its red and green signals and dragging an unwieldy tail of barges in its wake. Then a Margate passenger steamer, its electric lights gleaming from every porthole, swerved round to anchor, with its load of 2,000 fatigued excursionists. Over everything brooded an air of mystery, a spirit and feeling of strangeness, remoteness, and the inexplicable. As the broad, flat little boat bobbed its way under the shadow of enormous hulks, beneath stretched hawsers, and past buoys covered with green slime, Wraxall could scarcely believe that he was in the very heart of London, the most prosaic city in the world. He had a queer idea that almost anything might happen in this seeming waste of waters at this weird hour of 10 o'clock. It appeared incredible to him that only a mile or two away people were sitting in theatres applauding farces, and that at Cannon Street Station, a few yards off, other people were calmly taking the train to various highly respectable suburbs whose names he was gradually learning. He had the uplifting sensation of being in another world, which comes to us, sometimes, amid surroundings violently different from our usual surroundings. The most ordinary noises, of men calling, of a chain running through a slot, of a distant siren, translated themselves to his ears into terrible and haunting sounds, full of portentous significance. He looked over the side of the boat into the brown water, and asked himself what frightful secrets lay hidden in its death. Then he put his hand into his hip pocket and touched the stock of his Colt revolver. That familiar substance comforted him. The oarsman had instructions to drop slowly down to the pool, as the wide reach below the tower is called. These two men had not been previously informed of the precise object of the expedition, but now that they were safely afloat, Hazel judged it expedient to give them some notion of it. "We expect to come across a rather suspicious steam launch," he said. "My friend here is very anxious to get a sight of her, and until he has seen her, nothing definite can be done."
"What sort of craft is she, sir?" asked Stroke Oar, a fat-faced man who seemed absolutely incapable of any serious exertion.
"I don't know," Wraxall replied, "but as near as I can judge, she's about 60 feet in length, and painted black. I fancy I shall recognize her when I see her."
"Not much to go by, that," exclaimed the other man curtly, but he said no more. He, as well as his mate, had received from Theodore Wraxall 1 English sovereign as a kind of preliminary fee, and an English sovereign will do a lot towards silencing the natural sarcastic tendencies and free speech of a Thames waterman.
"There's one thing I noticed," said Wraxall suddenly, "and I forgot to tell you of it, Mr. Hazel. Her screw seemed to move with a rather irregular, lame sort of beat."
Both watermen burst into a laugh.
"Oh," said the fat rower, "I know what you're after, sir. It's Jack Everett's launch, commonly called Squirm. She's got a 4-bladed propeller, and one blade is broken off short."
"Aye, that's it, sure enough," agreed the man in the bows. "And if it's her you want, I see her lying up against Cherry Gardens Pier this very morning."
"Let us go to Cherry Gardens Pier, by all means, as soon as possible," Wraxall said, and the boat swung across stream, and then began to creep down by the right bank, feeding its way past wharves, many of which, even at that hour, were still busy with their cranes, that descended empty into the bellies of ships and came up full. As the two watermen gingerly manoeuvred the boat on the ebbing tide, Hazel explained to the millionaire that the Squirm was one of the most notorious craft on the river. It appeared that when anyone had a nefarious or underhand scheme afoot, which necessitated river work, Everett's launch was always available for a suitable monetary consideration. The Squirm had got itself into 1,000 scrapes, and out of those scrapes again with safety, if not precisely with honour. The river police kept a watchful eye on it, and the chief marvel about the whole thing was that old Everett, the owner, had never yet been seriously compromised in any illegal escapade. Not once had the officer of the law been able to prove anything definite against the proprietor of the Squirm, though several of its quondam hires were at that very moment in various of Her Majesty's prisons throughout the country. Latterly, however, the launch, with its damaged propeller, which Everett consistently refused to have repaired, had acquired an evil reputation, even among evil-doers, and this fraternity had gradually come to abandon it for less easily recognizable craft.
"Your friend, Mr. Tom Jackson," said Hazel to Wraxall, "committed an error of discretion when he hired the Squirm. A scoundrel of his experience and calibre ought certainly to have known better than that. You cannot fail to get a clue now." By this time the boat was approaching Cherry Gardens Pier, but unfortunately a thin night fog had swept over the river, and objects could not be discerned with any clearness beyond a distance of 30 yards. As the customs boat scraped down past the pier, all its occupants strained eyes for a glimpse of the mysterious launch, but nothing could be seen of it.
The boat continued to float idly downstream, the men resting on their oars. Then they narrowly escaped bumping a large Norwegian sailing vessel at anchor with her stem pointing downstream. This ship they passed on the port side. Just as they got clear of her bowsprit, the fat man cried out excitedly, "There's her nose!" And he put the boat about and began to pull back against the tide. And surely the missing Squirm was comfortably anchored on the starboard quarter of the Norwegian ship, hidden neatly between the ship and the shore. The men pulled very quietly alongside. Chapter 26. The Night Chase and the Mudlark. "I'll board her to start with," said Hazel, whispering to Rexel. "I'll make out that I suspect they've got dutiable goods on board, and that will give me a chance to have a good look at her." Dressed in his official overcoat and peaked cap, he stepped, rather jauntily as Rexel thought, onto the low deck of the launch. "Anyone aboard?" Rexel heard him cry out, and a woman's voice answered. "I'm a customs examining officer, and I want to search the launch," Hazel shouted, and then disappeared down into the little saloon amidships, and Rexel heard no more. It seemed to the millionaire that Hazel had been gone hours, but at length he returned. "Can't find anything," he said, as he jumped into the boat, and then privately to Rexel. "There's a woman on board. Looks as if she might coincide with your description of Miss Spencer. Steam's up, but there's no engineer. I asked where the engineer was, and she inquired what business that was of mine, and requested me to go through with my own business and clear off. Seems rather a smart sort. I poked my nose into everything, but I saw no sign of anyone else. Perhaps we'd better pull away and lie near for a bit, just to see if anything queer occurs." "You're quite sure he isn't on board?" Rexel asked. "Quite," said Hazel positively. "I know how to search a vessel. See this?" And he handed to Rexel a sort of steel skewer, about 2 feet long, with a wooden handle. "That," he said, "is one of the customs aids to searching." "I suppose it wouldn't do to go on board and carry off the lady," Rexel suggested doubtfully. "Well," Hazel began, with equal doubtfulness, "as for that..." "Where is he off?" It was the man in the bows who interrupted Hazel. Following the direction of the man's finger, both Hazel and Rexel saw with more or less distinctness a dinghy slip away from the forefoot of the Norwegian vessel and disappear downstream into the mist. "It's Jules, I'll swear," cried Rexel. "After him, man. 10 pounds apiece if we overtake him." "Lay down to it now, boys," said Hazel, and the heavy customs boat shot out in pursuit. "This is going to be a lark," Rexel remarked. "Depends on what you call a lark," said Hazel. "It's not much of a lark tearing down midstream like this in a fog. You never know when you mayn't be in Kingdom Come with all these barges knocking around. I expect that chap hid in the dinghy when he first caught sight of us, and then slipped his painter as soon as I'd gone." The boat was moving at a rapid pace with the tide. Steering was a matter of luck and instinct more than anything else. Every now and then Hazel, who held the lines, was obliged to jerk the boat's head sharply round to avoid a barge or an anchored vessel. It seemed to Rexel that vessels were anchored all over the stream. He looked about him anxiously, but for a long time he could see nothing but mist and vague nautical forms. Then suddenly he said, quietly enough, "We're on the right road. I can see him ahead. We're gaining on him." In another minute the dinghy was plainly visible, not 20 yards away, and the sculler, sculling frantically now, was unmistakably Jules. Jules in a light tweed suit and a bowler hat. "You were right," Hazel said. "This is a lark. I believe I'm getting quite excited. It's more exciting than playing the trombone in an orchestra. I'll run him down, eh? And then we can drag the chap in from the water." Rexel nodded, but at that moment a barge with a red sail set stood out of the fog clean across the bows of the customs boat, which narrowly escaped instant destruction. When they got clear and the usual interchange of calm, nonchalant swearing was over, the dinghy was barely to be discerned in the mist, and the fat man was breathing in such a manner that his sighs might almost have been heard on the banks. Rexel wanted violently to do something, but there was nothing to do, and he could only sit supine by Hazel's side in the stern sheets. Gradually they began again to overtake the dinghy, whose one-man crew was evidently tiring. As they came up, hand over fist, the dinghy's nose swerved aside, and the tiny craft passed down a water lane between two anchored mineral barges, which lay black and deserted about 50 yards from the Surrey shore. "To starboard," said Rexel. "No, man," Hazel replied. "We can't get through there. He's bound to come out below.
"It's only a feint. I'll keep our nose straight ahead."
And they went on, the fat man pounding away, with a face which glistened even in the thick gloom. It was an empty dinghy which emerged from between the two barges, and went drifting and revolving down towards Greenwich. The fat man gasped a word to his comrade, and the customs boat stopped dead.
"He's all right," said the man in the bows. "If it's him you want, he's on one of them barges, so you've only got to step on and take him off."
"That's all," said a voice out of the depths of the nearest barge, and it was the voice of Jules, otherwise known as Mr. Tom Jackson.
"Hear him?" said the fat man, smiling. "He's a good one, he is. But if I was you, Mr. Hazel, or you, sir, I shouldn't step on to that barge so quick as all that."
They backed the boat under the stem of the nearest barge and gazed upwards.
"It's all right," said Rexel to Hazel. "I've got a revolver. How can I clamber up there?"
"Yes, I dare say you've got a revolver all right," Hazel replied sharply. "But you mustn't use it. There mustn't be any noise. We should have the river police down on us in a twinkling if there was a revolver shot, and it would be the ruin of me. If an inquiry was held, the commissioners wouldn't take any official notice of the fact that my superior officer had put me on to this job, and I should be requested to leave the service."
"Have no fear on that score," said Rexel. "I shall, of course, take all responsibility."
"It wouldn't matter how much responsibility you took," Hazel retorted. "You wouldn't put me back into the service, and my career would be at an end."
"But there are other careers," said Rexel, who was really anxious to lame his ex-waiter by means of a judiciously aimed bullet. "There are other careers."
"The customs is my career," said Hazel, "so let's have no shooting. We'll wait about a bit. He can't escape. You can have my skewer if you like." And he gave Rexel his searching instrument.
"And you can do what you please, provided you do it neatly and don't make a row over it."
For a few moments the four men were passive in the boat, surrounded by swirling mist, with black water beneath them, and towering above them a half-loaded barge with the desperate and resourceful men on board. Suddenly the mist parted and shriveled away in patches, as though before the breath of some monster. The sky was visible. It was a clear sky, and the moon was shining. The transformation was just one of those meteorological quick changes which happen most frequently on a great river.
"That's a sight better," said the fat man.
At the same moment a head appeared over the edge of the barge. It was Jules' face, dark, sinister, and leering.
"Is it Mr. Rexel in that boat?" he inquired calmly. "Because if so, let Mr. Rexel step up. Mr. Rexel has caught me, and he can have me for the asking. Here I am."
He stood up to his full height on the barge, tall against the night sky, and all the occupants of the boat could see that he held firmly clasped in his right hand a short dagger.
"Now, Mr. Rexel, you've been after me for a long time," he continued. "Here I am. Why don't you step up? If you haven't got the pluck yourself, persuade someone else to step up in your place. The same fair treatment will be accorded to all."
And Jules laughed a low, penetrating laugh. He was in the midst of this laugh when he lurched suddenly forward.
"What are you doing off aboard my barge? Off you goes!"
It was a boy's small, shrill voice that sounded in the night. A ragged boy's small form had appeared silently behind Jules, and two small arms, with a vicious shove, precipitated him into the water. He fell with a fine gurgling splash. It was at once obvious that swimming was not among Jules' accomplishments. He floundered wildly and sank. When he reappeared, he was dragged into the customs boat. Rope was produced, and in a minute or two the man lay ignominiously bound in the bottom of the boat. With the aid of a mudlark, a mere barge boy, who probably had no more right on the barge than Jules himself, Rexel had won his game. For the first time for several weeks, the millionaire experienced a sensation of equanimity and satisfaction. He leant over the prostrate form of Jules, Hazel's professional skewer in his hand.
"What are you going to do with him now?" asked Hazel.
"We'll row up to the landing steps in front of the Grand Babylon. He shall be well lodged at my hotel, I promise him." Jules spoke no word. Before Rexel parted company with the customs man that night, Jules had been safely transported into the Grand Babylon Hotel, and the two watermen had received their £10 apiece.
"You will sleep here," said the millionaire to Mr. George Hazel. "It is late."
"With pleasure," said Hazel. The next morning he found a sumptuous breakfast awaiting him, and in his table napkin was a Bank of England note for £100. But, though he did not hear of them till much later,
many things had happened before Hazel consumed that sumptuous breakfast. End of chapter 25 and 26. Chapter 27 and 28 of the Grand Babylon Hotel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Anna Simon. The Grand Babylon Hotel by Arnold Bennett. Chapter 27. The Confession of Mr. Tom Jackson. It happened that the small bedroom occupied by Jules during the years he was head waiter at the Grand Babylon had remained empty since his sudden dismissal by Theodore Wraxall. No other head waiter had been formally appointed in his place, and, indeed, the absence of one man, even the unique Jules, could scarcely have been noticed in the enormous staff of a place like the Grand Babylon. The functions of a head waiter are generally more ornamental, spectacular, and morally impressive than useful, and it was so at the great hotel on the Embankment. Wraxall accordingly had the excellent idea of transporting his prisoner, with as much secrecy as possible, to this empty bedroom. There proved to be no difficulty in doing so. Jules showed himself perfectly amenable to a show of superior force. Wraxall took upstairs with him an old commissioner who had been attached to the outdoor service of the hotel for many years, a grey-haired man, wiry as a terrier and strong as a mastiff. Entering the bedroom with Jules, whose hands were bound, he told the commissioner to remain outside the door. Jules' bedroom was quite an ordinary apartment, though perhaps slightly superior to the usual accommodation provided for servants in the caravanserais of the West End. It was about 14 by 12. It was furnished with a bedstead, a small wardrobe, a small washstand and dressing table, and two chairs. There were two hooks behind the door, a strip of carpet by the bed, and some cheap ornaments on the iron mantelpiece. There was also one electric light. The window was a little square one, high up from the floor, and it looked on the inner quadrangle. The room was on the top story, the eighth, and from it you had a view sheer to the ground. 20 feet below ran a narrow cornice about a foot wide. 3 feet or so above the window, another and wider cornice jutted out, and above that was the high steep roof of the hotel, though you could not see it from the window. As Wraxall examined the window and the outlook, he said to himself that Jules could not escape by that exit, at any rate. He gave a glance up the chimney, and saw that the flue was far too small to admit a man's body. Then he called in the commissioner, and together they bound Jules firmly to the bedstead, allowing him, however, to lie down. All the while, the captive never opened his mouth, merely smiled a smile of disdain. Finally, Wraxall removed the ornaments, the carpet, the chairs, and the hooks, and wrenched away the switch of the electric light. Then he and the commissioner left the room, and Wraxall locked the door on the outside and put the key in his pocket. "You will keep watch here," he said to the commissioner, "through the night. You can sit on this chair. Don't go to sleep. If you hear the slightest noise in the room, blow your cap whistle. I will arrange to answer the signal. If there is no noise, do nothing whatever. I don't want this talked about, you understand? I shall trust you. You can trust me." "But the servants will see me here when they get up tomorrow," said the commissioner, with a faint smile, "and they will be pretty certain to ask what I'm doing of up here. What shall I say to them?" "You've been a soldier, haven't you?" asked Wraxall. "I've seen 3 campaigns, sir," was the reply, and, with a gesture of pardonable pride, the grey-haired fellow pointed to the medals on his breast. "Well, supposing you were on sentry duty, and some meddlesome person in camp asked you what you were doing, what should you say?" "I should tell him to clear off, or take the consequences, and pretty quick, too." "Do that tomorrow morning, then, if necessary," said Wraxall, and departed. It was then about 1 o'clock a.m. The millionaire retired to bed. Not his own bed, but a bed on the 7th story. He did not, however, sleep very long. Shortly after dawn, he was wide awake, and thinking busily about Jules. He was, indeed, very curious to know Jules' story, and he determined, if the thing could be done at all, by persuasion or otherwise, to extract it from him. With a man of Theodore Wraxall's temperament, there is no time like the present, and at 6 o'clock, as the bright morning sun brought gaiety into the window, he dressed and went upstairs again to the 8th story. The commissionaire sat stolid but alert on his chair, and, at the sight of his master, rose and saluted. "Anything happened?" Wraxall asked. "Nothing, sir." "Servants say anything?" "Only 12 or so of 'em are up yet, sir. One of them asked what I was playing at, and so I told her I was looking after a bull bitch and a litter of pups that you was very particular about, sir.
Good, said Rexall, as he unlocked the door and entered the room. All was exactly as he had left it, except that Jules, who had been lying on his back, had somehow turned over and was now lying on his face. He gazed silently, scowling at the millionaire. Rexall greeted him and ostentatiously took a revolver from his hip pocket and laid it on the dressing-table. Then he seated himself on the dressing-table by the side of the revolver, his legs dangling an inch or two above the floor.
"I want to have a talk to you, Jackson," he began.
"You can talk to me as much as you like," said Jules. "I shan't interfere. You may bet on that."
"I should like you to answer some questions."
"That's different," said Jules. "I'm not going to answer any questions while I'm tied up like this. You may bet on that, too."
"It will pay you to be reasonable," said Rexall.
"I'm not going to answer any questions while I'm tied up."
"I'll unfasten your legs, if you like," Rexall suggested politely. "Then you can sit up. It's no use you pretending you've been uncomfortable, because I know you haven't. I calculate you've been treated very handsomely, my son. There you are." And he loosened the lower extremities of his prisoner from their bonds. "Now, I repeat, you may as well be reasonable. You may as well admit that you've been fairly beaten in the game, and act accordingly. I was determined to beat you, by myself, without the police, and I've done it."
"You've done yourself," retorted Jules. "You've gone against the law. If you'd had any sense, you wouldn't have meddled. You'd have left everything to the police. They'd have muddled about for a year or two, and then known nothing. Who's going to tell the police now? Are you? Are you going to give me up to 'em, and say, 'Here, I've caught him for you'? If you do, they'll ask you to explain several things, and then you'll look foolish. One crime doesn't excuse another, and you'll find that out."
With unerring insight, Jules had perceived exactly the difficulty of Rexall's position, and it was certainly a difficulty which Rexall did not attempt to minimize to himself. He knew well that it would have to be faced. He did not, however, allow Jules to guess his thoughts. "Meanwhile," he said calmly to the other, "you're here and my prisoner. You've committed a variegated assortment of crimes, and among them is murder. You're due to be hung. You know that. There is no reason why I should call in the police at all. It will be perfectly easy for me to finish you off, as you deserve, myself. I shall only be carrying out justice and robbing the hangman of his fee. Precisely as I brought you into the hotel, I can take you out again. A few days ago you borrowed or stole a steam yacht at Ostend. What you've done with it I don't know, nor do I care, but I strongly suspect that my daughter had a narrow escape of being murdered on your steam yacht. Now I have a steam yacht of my own. Suppose I use it as you used yours. Suppose I smuggle you onto it, steam out to sea, and then ask you to step off it into the ocean one night. Such things have been done. Such things will be done again. If I acted so, I should at least have the satisfaction of knowing that I had relieved society from the incubus of a scoundrel."
"But you won't," Jules murmured.
"No," said Rexall steadily, "I won't, if you behave yourself this morning. But I swear to you that if you don't, I will never rest till you're dead, police or no police. You don't know Theodore Rexall."
"I believe you mean it,"
Jules exclaimed, with an air of surprised interest, as though he had discovered something of importance.
"I believe I do," Rexall resumed. "Now listen. At the best, you will be given up to the police. At the worst, I shall deal with you myself. With the police, you may have a chance. You may get off with 20 years penal servitude, because, though it is absolutely certain that you murdered Reginald Dimmock, it would be a little difficult to prove the case against you. But with me, you would have no chance whatever. I have a few questions to put to you, and it will depend on how you answer them whether I give you up to the police or take the law into my own hands. And let me tell you that the latter course will be much simpler for me. And I would take it too, did I not feel that you were a very clever and exceptional man. Did I not have a sort of sneaking admiration for your detestable skill and ingenuity?" "You think, then, that I am clever?" said Jules.
"You are right. I am. I should have been much too clever for you if luck had not been against me. You owe your victory not to skill, but to luck. That is what the vanquished always say. Waterloo was a bit of pure luck for the English, no doubt, but it was Waterloo all the same.
Jules yawned elaborately.
"What do you want to know?" he inquired, with politeness.
"First and foremost, I want to know the names of your accomplices inside this hotel."
"I have no more," said Jules. "Rocco was the last."
"Don't begin by lying to me. If you had no accomplice, how did you contrive that one particular bottle of Romanée Conti should be served to His Highness Prince Eugen?"
"Then you discovered that in time, did you?" said Jules. "I was afraid so." "Let me explain that that needed no accomplice. The bottle was topmost in the bin, and naturally it would be taken. Moreover, I left it sticking out a little further than the rest."
"You did not arrange, then, that Hubert should be taken ill the night before last?"
"I had no idea," said Jules, "that the excellent Hubert was not enjoying his accustomed health."
"Tell me," said Rexel, "who or what is the origin of your vendetta against the life of Prince Eugen?"
"I had no vendetta against the life of Prince Eugen," said Jules, "at least not to begin with. I merely undertook, for a consideration, to see that Prince Eugen did not have an interview with a certain Mr. Samson Levi in London before a certain date. That was all. It seemed simple enough. I had been engaged in far more complicated transactions before. I was convinced that I could manage it with the help of Rocco and Miss Spencer."
"Is that woman your wife?"
"She would like to be," he sneered. "Please don't interrupt. I had completed my arrangements when you so inconsiderately bought the hotel. I don't mind admitting now that from the very moment when you came across me that night in the corridor, I was secretly afraid of you, though I scarcely admitted the fact even to myself then. I thought it safer to shift the scene of our operations to Ostend. I had meant to deal with Prince Eugen in this hotel, but I decided then to intercept him on the continent, and I dispatched Miss Spencer with some instructions. Troubles never come singly, and it happened that just then that fool Dimmock, who had been in the swim with us, chose to prove refractory. The slightest hitch would have upset everything, and I was obliged to clear him off the scene. He wanted to back out. He had a bad attack of conscience, and violent measures were essential. I regret his untimely decease, but he brought it on himself. Well, everything was going serenely when you and your brilliant daughter, apparently determined to meddle, turned up again among us at Ostend. Only 24 hours, however, had to elapse before the date which had been mentioned to me by my employers. I kept poor little Eugen for the allotted time, and then you managed to get hold of him. I do not deny that you scored there, though, according to my original instructions, you scored too late. The time had passed, and so far as I knew, it didn't matter a pin whether Prince Eugen saw Mr. Samson Levi or not. But my employers were still uneasy. They were uneasy even after little Eugen had lain ill in Ostend for several weeks. It appears that they feared that even at that date an interview between Prince Eugen and Mr. Samson Levi might work harm to them. So they applied to me again. This time they wanted Prince Eugen to be, finished off entirely. They offered high terms."
"What terms?"
"I had received £50,000 for the first job, of which Rocco had half. Rocco was also to be made a member of a certain famous European order, if things went right. That was what he coveted far more than the money, the vain fellow. For the second job I was offered £100,000, a tolerably large sum. I regret that I have not been able to earn it."
"Do you mean to tell me," asked Rexall, horror struck by this calm confession in spite of his previous knowledge, "that you were offered £100,000 to poison Prince Eugen?"
"You put it rather crudely," said Jules in reply. "I prefer to say that I was offered £100,000 if Prince Eugen should die within a reasonable time."
"And who were your damnable employers?"
"That, honestly, I do not know."
"You know, I suppose, who paid you the first £50,000, and who promised you the £100,000?
"Well," said Jules, "I know vaguely. I know that he came via Vienna from, Bosnia. My impression was that the affair had some bearing, direct or indirect, on the projected marriage of the King of Bosnia." He is a young monarch, scarcely out of political leading strings, as it were, and doubtless his ministers thought that they had better arrange his marriage for him. They tried last year, and failed because the princess whom they had in mind had cast her sparkling eyes on another prince. That prince happened to be Prince Eugen of Posen. The ministers of the King of Bosnia knew exactly the circumstances of Prince Eugen. They knew that he could not marry without liquidating his debts, and they knew that he could only liquidate his debts through this Jew, Samson Levi. Unfortunately for me, they ultimately wanted to make too sure of Prince Eugen. They were afraid he might, after all, arrange his marriage without the aid of Mr. Samson Levi. And so, well, you know the rest. It is a pity that the poor little innocent King of Bosnia can't have the princess of his minister's choice. Then you think that the king himself had no part in this abominable crime?
I think decidedly not.
I'm glad of that, said Rexall simply. And now, the name of your immediate employer. He was merely an agent. He called himself Sleszak, S-L-E-S-Z-A-K. But I imagine that that wasn't his real name. I don't know his real name. An old man, he often used to be found at the Hotel Ritz, Paris. Mr. Sleszak and I will meet, said Rexall. Not in this world, said Jules quickly. He is dead. I heard only last night, just before our little tussle. There was a silence. It is well, said Rexall at length. Prince Eugen lives, despite all plots. After all, justice is done. Mr. Rexall is here, but he can see no one, miss. The words came from behind the door, and the voice was the commissionaire's. Rexall started up and went towards the door. Nonsense, was the curt reply, in feminine tones. Move aside instantly. The door opened, and Nella entered. There were tears in her eyes. "Oh, Dad," she exclaimed, "I've only just heard you were in the hotel. We looked for you everywhere. Come at once. Prince Eugen is dying." Then she saw the man sitting on the bed, and stopped. Later, when Jules was alone again, he remarked to himself, "I may get that 100,000." Chapter 28. The State Bedroom Once More. When, immediately after the episode of the bottle of Romanée Conti in the state dining room, Prince Aribert and old Hans found that Prince Eugen had sunk in an unconscious heap over his chair, both the former thought at the first instant that Eugen must have already tasted the poisoned wine. But a moment's reflection showed that this was not possible. If the hereditary Prince of Posen was dying or dead, his condition was due to some other agency than the Romanée Conti. Aribert bent over him, and a powerful odour from the man's lips at once disclosed the cause of the disaster. It was the odour of laudanum. Indeed, the smell of that sinister drug seemed now to float heavily over the whole table. Across Aribert's mind there flashed then the true explanation. Prince Eugen, taking advantage of Aribert's attention being momentarily diverted, and yielding to a sudden impulse of despair, had decided to poison himself, and had carried out his intention on the spot. The laudanum must have been already in his pocket, and this fact went to prove that the unfortunate prince had previously contemplated such a proceeding, even after his definite promise. Aribert remembered now with painful vividness his nephew's words. "I withdraw my promise. Observe that. I withdraw it." It must have been instantly after the utterance of that formal withdrawal that Eugen attempted to destroy himself. "It's laudanum, Hans," Aribert exclaimed, rather helplessly. "Surely His Highness has not taken poison," said Hans. "It is impossible." "I fear it is only too possible," said the other. "It's laudanum. What are we to do? Quick, man!" "His Highness must be roused, Prince. He must have an emetic. We had better carry him to the bedroom." They did, and laid him on the great bed. And then Aribert mixed an emetic of mustard and water, and administered it, but without any effect. The sufferer lay motionless, with every muscle relaxed. His skin was ice-cold to the touch, and the eyelids, half-drawn, showed that the pupils were painfully contracted. "Go out and send for a doctor, Hans. Say that Prince Eugen has been suddenly taken ill, but that it isn't serious. The truth must never be known." "He must be roused, sire," Hans said again, as he hurried from the room.
Aribert lifted his nephew from the bed, shook him, pinched him, flicked him cruelly, shouted at him, dragged him about, but to no avail. At length he desisted, from mere physical fatigue, and laid the prince back again on the bed. Every minute that elapsed seemed an hour. Alone with the unconscious organism, in the silence of the great stately chamber, under the cold yellow glare of the electric lights, Aribert became a prey to the most despairing thoughts. The tragedy of his nephew's career forced itself upon him, and it occurred to him that an early and shameful death had all along been inevitable for this good-natured, weak-purposed, unhappy child of a historic throne. A little good fortune, and his character, so evenly balanced between right and wrong, might have followed the proper path, and Eugen might have figured, at any rate, with dignity on the European stage. But now it appeared that all was over, the last stroke played. And in this disaster, Aribert saw the ruin of his own hopes. For Aribert would have to occupy his nephew's throne, and he felt instinctively that nature had not cut him out for a throne. By a natural impulse, he inwardly rebelled against the prospect of monarchy. Monarchy meant so much for which he knew himself to be entirely unfitted. It meant a political marriage, which means a forced marriage, a union against inclination. And then, what of Nella? Nella! Hans returned. "I've sent for the nearest doctor, and also for a specialist," he said. "Good," said Aribert. "I hope they will hurry." Then he sat down and wrote a card. "Take this yourself to Miss Rexall. If she is out of the hotel, ascertain where she is and follow her. Understand, it is of the first importance." Hans bowed and departed for the second time, and Aribert was alone again. He gazed at Eugen, and made another frantic attempt to rouse him from the deadly stupor, but it was useless. He walked away to the window. Through the opened casement he could hear the tinkle of passing hansoms on the embankment below, whistles of doorkeepers, and the hoot of steam tugs on the river. The world went on as usual, it appeared. It was an absurd world. He desired nothing better than to abandon his princely title, and live as a plain man, the husband of the finest woman on earth. But now... Pah! How selfish he was, to be thinking of himself when Eugen lay dying! Yet... Nella! The door opened, and a man entered, who was obviously the doctor. A few curt questions, and he had grasped the essentials of the case. "Oblige me by ringing the bell, Prince. I shall want some hot water, and an able-bodied man, and a nurse." "Who wants a nurse?" said a voice, and Nella came quietly in. "I am a nurse," she added to the doctor, "and at your orders." The next 2 hours were a struggle between life and death. The first doctor, a specialist who followed him, Nella, Prince Aribert, and old Hans, formed, as it were, a league to save the dying man. None else in the hotel knew the real seriousness of the case. When a prince falls ill, and especially by his own act, the precise truth is not issued broadcast to the universe. According to official intelligence, a prince is never seriously ill until he is dead. Such is statecraft. The worst feature of Prince Eugen's case was that emetics proved futile. Neither of the doctors could explain their failure, but it was only too apparent. The league was reduced to helplessness. At last, the great specialist from Manchester Square gave it out that there was no chance for Prince Eugen unless the natural vigour of his constitution should prove capable of throwing off the poison unaided by scientific assistance, as a drunkard can sleep off his potion. Everything had been tried, even to artificial respiration and the injection of hot coffee. Having emitted this pronouncement, the great specialist from Manchester Square left. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. By one of those strange and futile coincidences which sometimes startle us by their subtle significance, the specialist met Theodore Rexall and his captive as they were entering the hotel. Neither had the least suspicion of the other's business. In the state bedroom, the small group of watchers surrounded the bed. The slow minutes filed away in dreary procession. Another hour passed. Then the figure on the bed, hitherto so motionless, twitched and moved. The lips parted. "There is hope," said the doctor, and administered a stimulant which was handed to him by Nella. In a quarter of an hour the patient had regained consciousness. For the 10,000th time in the history of medicine, a sound constitution had accomplished a miracle impossible to the accumulated medical skill of centuries. In due course, the doctor left, saying that Prince Eugen was on the high road to recovery, and promising to come again within a few hours. Morning had dawned. Nella drew the great curtains and let in a flood of sunlight. Old Hans, overcome by fatigue, dozed in a chair in a far corner of the room. The reaction had been too much for him. Nella and Prince Aribert looked at each other. They had not exchanged a word about themselves, yet each knew what the other had been thinking. They clasped hands with a perfect understanding. Their brief love-making had been of the silent kind, and it was silent now. No word was uttered. A shadow had passed from over them, but only their eyes expressed relief and joy. "Aribert!" The faint call came from the bed. Aribert went to the bedside, while Nella remained near the window. "What is it, Eugen?" he said. "You are better now."
"You think so?" murmured the other. "I want you to forgive me for all this, Aribert. I must have caused you an intolerable trouble. I did it so clumsily. That is what annoys me. Laudanum was a feeble expedient, but I could think of nothing else, and I daren't ask anyone for advice. I was obliged to go out and buy the stuff for myself. It was all very awkward. But, thank goodness, it has not been ineffectual."
"What do you mean, Eugen? You are better. In a day or so you will be perfectly recovered."
"I am dying," said Eugen quietly. "Do not be deceived. I die because I wish to die. It is bound to be so. I know by the feel of my heart. In a few hours it will be over. The throne of Posen will be yours, Aribert. You will fill it more worthily than I have done. Don't let them know over there that I poisoned myself. Swear Hans to secrecy, swear the doctors to secrecy, and breathe no word yourself. I have been a fool, but I do not wish it to be known that I was also a coward. Perhaps it is not cowardice. Perhaps it is courage, after all. Courage to cut the knot. I could not have survived the disgrace of any revelations, Aribert, and revelations would have been sure to come. I have made a fool of myself, but I am ready to pay for it. We of Posen, we always pay. Everything except our debts. Ah, those debts! Had it not been for those, I could have faced her who was to have been my wife, to have shared my throne. I could have hidden my past and begun again. With her help, I really could have begun again. But fate has been against me, always, always. By the way, what was that plot against me, Herbert? I forget." His eyes closed. There was a sudden noise. Old Hans had slipped from his chair to the floor. He picked himself up, dazed, and crept shamefacedly out of the room. Aribert took his nephew's hand. "Nonsense, Eugen. You're dreaming. You will be all right soon. Pull yourself together." "All because of a million," the sick man moaned. "One miserable million English pounds. The national debt of Posen is 50 millions, and I, the Prince of Posen, couldn't borrow one. If I could have got it, I might have held my head up again. Goodbye, Aribert." "Who is that girl?"
Aribert looked up. Nella was standing silent at the foot of the bed, her eyes moist. She came round to the bedside and put her hand on the patient's heart. Scarcely could she feel its pulsation, and to Aribert her eyes expressed a sudden despair. At that moment Hans re-entered the room and beckoned to her.
"I've heard that Herr Rexel has returned to the hotel," he whispered, "and that he's captured that man Jules, who they say is such a villain."
Several times during the night Nella inquired for her father, but could gain no knowledge of his whereabouts. Now, at 6:30 in the morning, a rumour had mysteriously spread among the servants of the hotel about the happenings of the night before. How it had originated no one could have determined, but it had originated.
"Where is my father?" Nella asked of Hans.
He shrugged his shoulders and pointed upwards. "Somewhere at the top, they say." Nella almost ran out of the room. Her interruption of the interview between Jules and Theodore Rexel has already been described. As she came downstairs with her father, she said again,
Prince Eugen is dying, but I think you can save him.
I? Exclaimed Theodore.
Yes, she repeated positively. I will tell you what I want you to do, and you must do it.
End of chapter 27 and 28.
Chapter 29 and 30 of the Grand Babylon Hotel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Anna Simon. The Grand Babylon Hotel by Arnold Bennett. Chapter 29. Theodore is called to the rescue. As Nella passed downstairs from the top story with her father, the lifts had not yet begun to work, she drew him into her own room and closed the door.
"What's this all about?"
he asked, somewhat mystified, and even alarmed by the extreme seriousness of her face.
"Dad," the girl began, "you are very rich, aren't you? Very, very rich?"
She smiled anxiously, timidly. He did not remember to have seen that expression on her face before. He wanted to make a facetious reply, but checked himself.
"Yes," he said, "I am. You ought to know that by this time."
How soon could you realize £1,000,000?
A million? What?
He cried. Even he was staggered by her calm reference to this gigantic sum.
What on earth are you driving at?
£1,000,000, I said. That is to say, $5,000,000. How soon could you realize as much as that?
Oh, he answered, in about a month, if I went about it neatly enough. I could unload as much as that in a month without scaring Wall Street and other places, but it would want some arrangement.
Useless, she exclaimed. Couldn't you do it quicker, if you really had to?
If I really had to, I could fix it in a week, but it would make things lively, and I should lose on the job.
Couldn't you, she persisted, couldn't you go down this morning and raise £1,000,000, somehow, if it was a matter of life and death?
He hesitated. "Look here, Nella," he said. "What is it you've got up your sleeve?"
"Just answer my question, Dad, and try not to think that I'm a stark, staring lunatic."
"I rather expect I could get £1,000,000 this morning, even in London. But it would cost pretty dear. It might cost me £50,000, and there would be the dickens of an upset in New York, a sort of grand universal slump in my holdings."
"Why should New York know anything about it?"
"Why should New York know anything about it?" he repeated. "My girl, when anyone borrows £1,000,000, the whole world knows about it. Do you reckon that I can go up to the governors of the Bank of England and say, 'Look here, lend Theodore Wraxall £1,000,000 for a few weeks, and he'll give you an IOU and a covering note on stocks?'"
"But you could get it," she asked again.
"If there is £1,000,000 in London, I guess I could handle it," he replied.
"Well, Dad," and she put her arms round his neck, "you've just got to go out and fix it. See, it's for me. I've never asked you for anything really big before, but I do now, and I want it so badly."
He stared at her. "I award you the prize," he said at length. "You deserve it for colossal and immense coolness. Now you can tell me the true inward meaning of all this rigmarole. What is it?"
"I want it for Prince Eugen," she began, at first hesitatingly, with pauses. "He's ruined, unless he can get £1,000,000 to pay off his debts. He's dreadfully in love with the princess, and he can't marry her because of this. Her parents wouldn't allow it. He was to have got it from Samson Levi, but he arrived too late, owing to Jules."
"I know all about that, perhaps more than you do. But I don't see how it affects you or me."
"The point is this, Dad," Nella continued. "He's tried to commit suicide. He's so hipped. Yes, real suicide. He took laudanum last night. It didn't kill him straight off. He's got over the first shock, but he's in a very weak state, and he means to die. And I truly believe he will die. Now, if you could let him have that million, Dad, you would save his life."
Nella's item of news was a considerable and disconcerting surprise to Wraxall, but he hid his feelings fairly well.
"I haven't the least desire to save his life, Nell, I don't overmuch respect your Prince Eugen. I've done what I could for him, but only for the sake of seeing fair play, and because I object to conspiracies and secret murders. It's a different thing if he wants to kill himself. What I say is, let him. Who is responsible for his being in debt to the tune of £1,000,000? He's only got himself and his bad habits to thank for that. I suppose if he does happen to peg out, the throne of Posen will go to Prince Aribert. And a good thing, too. Aribert is worth 20 of his nephew.
That's just it, Dad, she said, eagerly following up her chance. I want you to save Prince Eugen just because Aribert, Prince Aribert, doesn't wish to occupy the throne. He'd much prefer not to have it.
Much prefer not to have it? Don't talk nonsense. If he's honest with himself, he'll admit that he'll be jolly glad to have it. Thrones are in his blood, so to speak.
You are wrong, father, and the reason is this. If Prince Aribert ascended the throne of Posen, he would be compelled to marry a princess.
Well, a prince ought to marry a princess.
But he doesn't want to. He wants to give up all his royal rights and live as a subject. He wants to marry a woman who isn't a princess.
Is she rich? Her father is, said the girl.
Oh, Dad, can't you guess? He loves me.
Her head fell on Theodore's shoulder, and she began to cry. The millionaire whistled a very high note.
Nell, he said at length, and you? Do you sort of cling to him?
Dad, she answered, you are stupid. Do you imagine I should worry myself like this if I didn't?
She smiled through her tears. She knew from her father's tone that she had accomplished a victory.
It's a mighty queer arrangement, Theodore remarked. But of course, if you think it'll be of any use, you'd better go down and tell your Prince Eugen that that million can be fixed up, if he really needs it. I expect there'll be decent security, or Samson Levi wouldn't have mixed himself up in it.
Thanks, Dad. Don't come with me. I may manage better alone.
She gave a formal little curtsy and disappeared. Wraxall, who had the talent, so necessary to millionaires, of attending to several matters at once, the large with the small, went off to give orders about the breakfast and the remuneration of his assistant of the evening before, Mr. George Hazel. He then sent an invitation to Mr. Felix Babylon's room, asking that gentleman to take breakfast with him. After he had related to Babylon the history of Jules's capture, and had a long discussion with him upon several points of hotel management, and especially as to the guarding of wine cellars, Wraxall put on his hat, sallied forth into the Strand, hailed a hansom, and was driven to the city. The order and nature of his operations there were too complex and technical to be described here. When Nella returned to the state bedroom, both the doctor and the great specialist were again in attendance. The two physicians moved away from the bedside as she entered, and began to talk quietly together in the embrasure of the window.
"A curious case," said the specialist.
"Yes, of course, as you say, it's a neurotic temperament that's at the bottom of the trouble. When you've got that and a vigorous constitution working one against the other, the results are apt to be distinctly curious. Do you consider there is any hope, Sir Charles?"
"If I'd seen him when he recovered consciousness, I should have said there was hope. Frankly, when I left last night, or rather this morning, I didn't expect to see the prince alive again, let alone conscious and able to talk. According to all the rules of the game, he ought to get over the shock to the system with perfect ease and certainty. But I don't think he will. I don't think he wants to. And moreover, I think he is still under the influence of suicidal mania. If he had a razor, he would cut his throat. You must keep his strength up. Inject, if necessary. I will come in this afternoon. I am due now at St. James's Palace." And the specialist hurried away, with an elaborate bow and a few hasty words of polite reassurances to Prince Aribert. When he had gone, Prince Aribert took the other doctor aside. "Forget everything, doctor," he said, "except that I am one man and you are another, and tell me the truth. Shall you be able to save His Highness? Tell me the truth."
"There is no truth," was the doctor's reply. "The future is not in our hands, prince."
"But you are hopeful, yes or no?"
The doctor looked at Prince Aribert.
"No," he said shortly, "I am not. I am never hopeful when the patient is not on my side."
"You mean?"
"I mean that His Royal Highness has no desire to live. You must have observed that.
Only too well, said Aribert.
And you are aware of the cause?
Aribert nodded an affirmative.
But cannot remove it?
No, said Aribert. He felt a touch on his sleeve. It was Nella's finger. With a gesture, she beckoned him towards the anteroom.
If you choose, she said, when they were alone, Prince Eugen can be saved. I have arranged it.
You have arranged it? He bent over her, almost with an air of alarm.
Go and tell him that the £1,000,000 which is so necessary to his happiness will be forthcoming. Tell him that it will be forthcoming today, if that will be any satisfaction to him.
But what do you mean by this, Nella?
I mean what I say, Aribert. And she sought his hand and took it in hers. Just what I say. If £1,000,000 will save Prince Eugen's life, it is at his disposal.
But how have you managed it? By what miracle?
My father, she replied softly, will do anything that I ask him. Do not let us waste time. Go and tell Eugen it is arranged, that all will be well. Go.
But we cannot accept this enormous, this incredible favour. It is impossible.
Aribert, she said quickly, remember you are not in Posen holding a court reception. You are in England, and you are talking to an American girl who has always been in the habit of having her own way.
The prince threw up his hands and went back into the bedroom. The doctor was at a table writing out a prescription. Aribert approached the bedside, his heart beating furiously. Eugen greeted him with a faint, fatigued smile.
Eugen, he whispered, listen carefully to me. I have news. With the assistance of friends, I have arranged to borrow that million for you. It is quite settled, and you may rely on it. But you must get better. Do you hear me?
Eugen almost sat up in bed.
Tell me I'm not delirious, he exclaimed.
Of course you aren't, Aribert replied.
But you mustn't sit up. You must take care of yourself.
Who will lend the money? Eugen asked in a feeble, happy whisper.
Never mind, you shall hear later. Devote yourself now to getting better.
The change in the patient's face was extraordinary. His mind seemed to have put on an entirely different aspect. The doctor was startled to hear him murmur a request for food. As for Aribert, he sat down, overcome by the turmoil of his own thoughts. Till that moment, he felt that he had never appreciated the value and the marvellous power of mere money, of the lucre which philosophers pretend to despise and men sell their souls for. His heart almost burst in its admiration for that extraordinary Nella, who by mere personal force had raised two men out of the deepest slough of despair to the blissful heights of hope and happiness.
"These Anglo-Saxons," he said to himself, "what a race!"
By the afternoon, Eugen was noticeably and distinctly better. The physicians, puzzled for the third time by the progress of the case, announced now that all danger was past. The tone of the announcement seemed to Aribert to imply that the fortunate issue was due wholly to unrivalled medical skill, but perhaps Aribert was mistaken. Anyhow, he was in a most charitable mood and prepared to forgive anything.
"Nella," he said a little later, when they were by themselves again in the antechamber, "what am I to say to you? How can I thank you? How can I thank your father?"
"You'd better not thank my father," she said. "Dad will affect to regard the thing as a purely business transaction, as of course it is. As for me, you can...
"Well?"
"Kiss me," she said. "There! Are you sure you've formally proposed to me, mon prince?"
"Ah, Nell," he exclaimed, putting his arms round her again. "Be mine. That is all I want."
"You'll find," she said, "that you'll want Dad's consent too."
"Will he make difficulties?"
"He could not, Nell, not with you."
"Better ask him," she said sweetly.
A moment later, Rexel himself entered the room.
"Going on all right?" he inquired, pointing to the bedroom.
"Excellently," the lovers answered together, and they both blushed.
"Ah," said Rexel. "Then, if that's so, and you can spare a minute, I've something to show you, Prince."
Chapter 30. Conclusion.
"I've a great deal to tell you, Prince," Rexel began, as soon as they were out of the room. "And also, as I said, something to show you. Will you come to my room? We will talk there first. The whole hotel is humming with excitement."
"With pleasure," said Aribert.
"Glad His Highness Prince Eugen is recovering," Rexel said, urged by considerations of politeness.
"Ah, as to that," Aribert began.
"If you don't mind, we'll discuss that later, Prince," Rexel interrupted him. They were in the proprietor's private room. "I want to tell you all about last night," Rexel resumed, "about my capture of Jules and my examination of him this morning." And he launched into a full account of the whole thing, down to the least details. "You see," he concluded, "that our suspicions as to Bosnia were tolerably correct. But as regards Bosnia, the more I think about it, the surer I feel that nothing can be done to bring their criminal politicians to justice."
"And as to Jules, what do you propose to do?"
"Come this way," said Rexel, and led Aribert to another room. A sofa in this room was covered with a linen cloth. Rexel lifted the cloth. He could never deny himself a dramatic moment, and disclosed the body of a dead man. It was Jules, dead, but without a scratch or mark on him. "I have sent for the police. Not a street constable, but an official from Scotland Yard," said Rexel.
"How did this happen?" Aribert asked, amazed and startled.
"I understood you to say that he was safely immured in the bedroom."
"So he was," Rexel replied.
"I went up there this afternoon, chiefly to take him some food. The commissionaire was on guard at the door. He had heard no noise, nothing unusual. Yet, when I entered the room, Jules was gone. He had by some means or other loosened his fastenings. He had then managed to take the door off the wardrobe. He had moved the bed in front of the window, and by pushing the wardrobe door 3 parts out of the window, and lodging the inside end of it under the rail at the head of the bed, he had provided himself with a sort of insecure platform outside the window. All this he did without making the least sound. He must then have got through the window and stood on a little platform. With his fingers he would just be able to reach the outer edge of the wide cornice under the roof of the hotel. By main strength of arms he had swung himself onto this cornice, and so got on to the roof proper. He would then have the run of the whole roof. At the side of the building facing Salisbury Lane there is an iron fire escape, which runs right down from the ridge of the roof into a little sunk yard level with the cellars. Jules might have thought that his escape was accomplished, but it unfortunately happened that one rung in the iron escape ladder had rusted rotten through being badly painted. It gave way, and Jules, not expecting anything of the kind, fell to the ground. That was the end of all his cleverness and ingenuity." As Rexel ceased speaking, he replaced the linen cloth with a gesture from which reverence was not wholly absent. "When the grave had closed over the dark and tempestuous career of Tom Jackson, once the pride of the Grand Babylon, there was little trouble for the people whose adventures we have described. Miss Spencer, that yellow-haired, faithful slave and attendant of a brilliant scoundrel, was never heard of again. Possibly to this day she survives, a mystery to her fellow creatures, in the pension of some cheap foreign boarding-house. As for Rocco, he certainly was heard of again. Several years after the events set down, it came to the knowledge of Felix Babylon that the unrivalled Rocco had reached Buenos Aires, and by his culinary skill was there making the fortune of a new and splendid hotel. Babylon transmitted the information to Theodore Rexel, and Rexel might, had he chosen, have put the forces of the law in motion against him. But Rexel, seeing that everything pointed to the fact that Rocco was now pursuing his vocation honestly, decided to leave him alone. The one difficulty which Rexel experienced after the demise of Jules, and it was a difficulty which he had, of course, anticipated, was connected with the police. The police, very properly, wanted to know things. They desired to be informed what Rexel had been doing in the Dimmock affair between his first visit to Ostend and his sending for them to take charge of Jules' dead body. And Rexel was by no means inclined to tell them everything. Beyond question, he had transgressed the laws of England, and possibly also the laws of Belgium, and the moral excellence of his motives in doing so was, of course, in the eyes of legal justice, no excuse for such conduct. The inquest upon Jules aroused some bother, and about 99 separate and distinct rumours. In the end, however, a compromise was arrived at.
Rexall's first aim was to pacify the inspector whose clue, which by the way was a false one, he had so curtly declined to follow up. That done, the rest needed only tact and patience. He proved, to the satisfaction of the authorities, that he had acted in a perfectly honest spirit, though with a high hand, and that substantial justice had been done. Also, he subtly indicated that, if it came to the point, he should defy them to do their worst. Lastly, he was able, through the medium of the United States Ambassador, to bring certain soothing influences to bear upon the situation. One afternoon, a fortnight after the recovery of the hereditary Prince of Posen, Aribert, who was still staying at the Grand Babylon, expressed a wish to hold converse with a millionaire. Prince Eugen, accompanied by Hans and some court officials whom he had sent for, had departed with immense éclat, armed with a comfortable million, to arrange formally for his betrothal. Touching the million, Eugen had given satisfactory personal security, and the money was to be paid off in 15 years. "You wish to talk to me, Prince," said Rexall to Aribert, when they were seated together in the former's room. "I wish to tell you," replied Aribert, "that it is my intention to renounce all my rights and titles as a royal prince of Posen, and to be known in future as Count Hartz, a rank to which I am entitled through my mother. Also, that I have a private income of £10,000 a year, and a chateau and a town house in Posen. I tell you this because I am here to ask the hand of your daughter in marriage. I love her, and I am vain enough to believe that she loves me. I have already asked her to be my wife, and she has consented. We await your approval." "You honour us, Prince," said Rexall with a slight smile, "and in more ways than one. May I ask your reason for renouncing your princely titles?" "Simply because the idea of a morganatic marriage would be as repugnant to me as it would be to yourself and to Nella." "That is good." The prince laughed. "I suppose it has occurred to you that £10,000 per annum, for a man in your position, is a somewhat small income. Nella is frightfully extravagant. I've known her to spend $60,000 in a single year, and have nothing to show for it at the end. Why, she would ruin you in 12 months. "Nella must reform her ways," Aribert said. "If she is content to do so," Rexall went on, "well and good. I consent." "In her name and my own, I thank you," said Aribert gravely. "And," the millionaire continued, "so that she may not have to reform too fiercely, I shall settle on her absolutely, with reversion to your children, if you have any, a lump sum of $50 million, that is to say, £10 million, in sound, selected railway stock. I reckon that is about half my fortune. Nella and I have always shared equally." Aribert made no reply. The two men shook hands in silence, and then it happened that Nella entered the room. That night, after dinner, Rexall and his friend Felix Babylon were walking together on the terrace of the Grand Babylon Hotel. Felix had begun the conversation. "I suppose, Rexall," he had said, "you aren't getting tired of the Grand Babylon?" "Why do you ask?" "Because I am getting tired of doing without it. A thousand times since I sold it to you, I have wished I could undo the bargain. I can't bear idleness. Will you sell?" "I might," said Rexall. "I might be induced to sell." "What will you take, my friend?" asked Felix. "What I gave," was the quick answer. "Ah," Felix exclaimed, "I sell you my hotel with Jules, with Rocco, with Miss Spencer? You go and lose all those three inestimable servants, and then offer me the hotel without them at the same price? It is monstrous." The little man laughed heartily at his own wit. "Nevertheless," he added, "we will not quarrel about the price. I accept your terms." And so was brought to a close the complex chain of events which had begun when Theodore Rexall ordered a steak and a bottle of Bass at the table d'hôte of the Grand Babylon Hotel. End of chapter 29 and 30. End of The Grand Babylon Hotel by Arnold Bennett. Recorded by Anna Simon. August 2008.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.